Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. How big are America's biggest banks? Well, the top six control assets equal to 62% of the nation's GDP. Six banks. So big, we can't afford to let them fail, even when they screw up. The chief of the biggest, Jamie Dimon, apologizing today to Congress for high-risk losses. The Tough View says, forget the apologies, let's break up the banks. This hour on Point, no more too big to fail. Is it time to break up the big banks? You can join the conversation. Is it time, past time, to swing the axe, pull the plug on the giants we've bailed out, cut them down to safer, more manageable size? Or do we need supersized banks for this global economy? You could comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'd love to hear from you. Later this hour, we'll hear a selection from animal scientist Temple Grandin's commencement speech at Franklin Pierce University, where she says, let's build things of value. But first, joining me today from Washington for a look at the big banks and JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon in the hot seat today is Nela Richardson, Senior Economics Analyst for Bloomberg Government. Nela, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here with you.
So what does the Senate Banking Committee really want out of Jamie Dimon today?
Well, first of all, they want Jamie Dimon to explain how a bank thought to be the most bestly managed risk management operation on Wall Street could incur a $2 billion loss, a loss of this magnitude. But what this loss has really touched a nerve on Congress about is the Volcker Rule and whether it should be extended to cover the kind of hedging that J.P. Morgan was doing that led to this loss.
He calls it hedging. Others call it speculation. We know more about it than we did when it first came out. Do we know enough to judge today?
And that's the problem because this is a problem that Mary Shapiro, chairman of the SEC, has also identified. Even under the Volcker Rule, there's a certain amount of speculation in the part of regulators in getting into the minds of the banks to figure out whether a hedge is indeed a hedge or a prop trade. We don't always know intent behind the trade. All we see is the trade as it happens, and people automatically see a big loss and think it's prop trading. However, what happens when people see a big
trade, proprietary trading with the banks.
Proprietary trading. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Banks using their own money to make what are considered bets on the direction of market movements and interest rates or exchange rates.
What are the stakes here? We're talking as he sits down. Some people will hear us later. Whatever his testimony, we know from his prepared remarks he's going to apologize. But what are the stakes for the banking system, for J.P. Morgan Chase, for the country in this appearance, Nela?
The stakes are incredibly high. Jamie Dimon was supposed to be the favorite banker on Wall Street, and he has been an advocate of the banking interests in regards to Dodd-Frank. And he had the credibility, both on Wall Street and in Washington, to make the case for the big banks. That credibility was undermined by this loss that he even claims was due to egregious risk management errors. The one thing that Jamie Dimon has to do in this testimony today is get his reputation back, both on Wall Street and in Washington.
How does he do that? I mean, it was just in April when there was speculation about big risks being taken by his chief investment office. He called them a tempest in a teapot. And then just weeks later, billions lost, and he's out saying egregious error. How does he get credibility? I mean, how can he do that sitting in a hearing?
That question strikes at the heart of this fine line that not only Jamie Dimon, but the Senate Banking Committee members will have to dance in between. You know, this loss was small, an economic molehill. When you compare this $2 billion loss to the $190 billion that J.P. Morgan has to absorb this loss, it was small. But it really talks about the risks that the banks are engaging in and whether they are equipped to manage this risk. And that is the question that the hearing is going to have to address.
Now, we know from 08 that there came a time right in front of all our faces where they were not equipped. And there was an enormous bailout and taxpayers were all there. But I'm sure that the senators will, posture fiercely before Jamie Dimon at points today. But does Congress have the independence and will in the face of banking lobby millions to really go at the banking interest that Jamie Dimon represents?
Well, Tom, I've spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill the past 2 weeks since J.P. Morgan had this loss, and I've been into the offices of many staff, and there is a concern on Capitol Hill of the way forward and how to make Dodd-Frank address this kind of risky trading. But your question leaves out one other event that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's an election year. And whether or not a lame duck Congress will be equipped, no matter how much money was given to individual members to actually address the risks in the financial system in an election year is a very good question.
Because there, a lot of them are up for re-election. Money pours
exactly.
in. Hey, we're talking about big banks today. Of course, Jamie Dimon at the head of the biggest, and whether they ought to be broken up to bring a more manageable banking system into play here. What about that? I mean, there was a vote a couple of years ago. A third of the Senate said they wanted that legislation, but it went down. Now there's this so-called Safe Banking Act. What about it? What's it call for, and what do its prospects look like, Neela?
Basically, what the Safe Banking Act would want to do is cut the size of the big banks in half. And it really did receive a lot of support, not just from Democrats in the Senate, but also from the ranking Republican, Senator Shelby. And so this act would basically cap the amount of deposits any one bank could have at 10% of the entire market share. And it would significantly reduce banks' ability to make these kind of large trading risks in our financial markets. But the question about this act is, will it also significantly reduce the funding sources to not only major U.S. corporations,
mm-hmm.
but homeowners? Most businesses get their funding, a lot of them, the big ones, from the capital markets. And if you limit the bank's ability to invest in the capital markets, you may limit funds that corporations use to hire workers, do research and development, and to build factories.
But presumably the capital's still out there, even if it's spread around more banks. We'll talk about that in this hour. Does the legislation have a snowball's chance?
It has more of a chance now than it did in April. I think that this loss at J.P. Morgan, though an economic molehill, has really opened a wound in the U.S. financial system and how the policy will support that system going forward.
Neela Richardson, Senior Economics Analyst for Bloomberg Government, joining us from Washington. Neela, thank you very much.
Great to be here with you. Thank you.
Joining us now from Amherst, Massachusetts, James Kwok, professor at the University of Connecticut Law School, fellow at the Harvard Law School Program on Corporate Governance. He blogs, along with economist Simon Johnson, at the Baseline Scenario. His latest book, co-authored with Johnson, is White House Burning, about the national debt. James Kwok, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You've been a strong voice for breaking up the banks. Why?
Well, this is basically a question about competition and the free market. So I think many people agree that our economy functions best when we have fair competition between different companies so that the best ideas and the best products can win out. Banks that are too big to fail essentially have a government subsidy, because the idea of being too big to fail is that in a crisis, if you're on the verge of collapse, the government will come to your rescue, just like the government did in 2008,
mm-hmm.
because we cannot afford to let these banks fail and take down the financial system.
Which means you've got taxpayers standing behind them.
Exactly. So that's what we call an implicit government guarantee. And that means that these banks are able to borrow money more cheaply than other banks. Because if you think about it from the lender's perspective, which in this case is, investors who are buying bonds in these banks, lenders think, I am more likely to get bailed out in the case of a crisis than if I lend to a smaller bank. So I'm going to lend my money to J.P. Morgan instead of to a smaller regional bank. That gives them a significant advantage in how much it costs them to essentially to get money to lend out to other people. And that's an unfair competitive advantage that distorts the nature of our financial system.
So there's unfair advantage there, you say, and we'll examine that more closely. But there's also this sort of unending risk. If they're that big, that much capital concentrated in just a handful of banks, that the taxpaying public may have to come in again at some point and bail them out.
Exactly. And that comes in a few forms. I mentioned that if a bank is too big to fail, then creditors have an incentive to lend money to it very cheaply. At the same time, the managers of the bank have an incentive to take on excessive risks, because they know that in the downside, some of these losses can be transferred not only to creditors, but also to the government. But then I think what the J.P. Morgan episode highlights mm-hmm. is another thing that you mentioned in your introduction, which is that these banks also today seem to be too big to manage. So in 2008, when people talked about banks being too complicated for the board of directors to understand what was going on, the poster child was Citigroup at the time. Mm-hmm. And people pointed to J.P. Morgan and Jamie Dimon as an example of a well-run bank. And I think what we've learned today is that even J.P. Morgan is, in a sense, too big to manage. The Wall Street Journal reported this week that, leaving aside what Jamie Dimon wanted the chief investment office to do, the mm-hmm. chief investment office is the group that that lost a lot of money on this trade. Apparently, some of the traders in London were ignoring instructions from the central office. So when you have an organization where traders are doing essentially what they want to maximize their personal profits and their personal bonuses, you can have outcomes like this.
But those personal profits and compensation give the top officers in these banks an enormous stake in keeping them big. I mean, that's one thing, presumably, that would go away. If you had smaller banks, you're not going to have $23 million or $100 million pay and profit packages.
Well, I mean, people would still make a lot of money. And one thing that that Neela mentioned earlier is that the Safe Banking Act really talks about dividing, essentially making these banks about half the size they are today. So I looked at some numbers. And if you look at the limits in the Safe Banking Act, no bank that exists in the United States today would have violated these limits a decade ago. So the growth that the Safe Banking Act tries to correct for basically happened in the last decade. And we know what else happened in the last decade as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon on the hot seat today in Congress. We are talking about the call, the real effort to just break up America's biggest banks, make them smaller, no more too big to fail. And voices right across the political spectrum calling for the breakup, but big interest pushing against it. Here was one moment. This was November last year, a CNBC Republican debate, primary debate. Candidate, former Utah Governor Republican John Huntsman spoke about what he would do about big banks if he were president. You'll hear Governor Huntsman, then a question from moderator John Harwood.
You know, today we've got, as I mentioned earlier, six institutions that are equal to 60-65% of our GDP, $9.4 trillion. They have an implied guaranteed by the taxpayers that they'll be protected. That's not fair. That's not right for the taxpayers.
So do you break them up?
I say we need to right-size them.
An implied guarantee by taxpayers for maybe unmanageably enormous banks. On the other hand, Jamie Dimon, talking today to the Senate Banking Committee in January, he was asked by Charlie Gasparino of the Fox Business Network about the possibility of breaking up the biggest banks. This was before the disclosures of the big billions trading loss. You'll hear Charlie Gasparino first.
Is there any talk in Washington about breaking up banks? Do you see it as building
speed? People periodically come up with that.
So it's not something that's
on the
agenda.
But if you did that, then you will seed global banking, which we do. Like I said, we bank some companies around the world. We spend $600 million in research. We move $10 trillion a day. We do financing. We deal with 16,000 investors around the world. And we raised $1.7 trillion for companies. We could do an $8 billion or $10 billion bridge loan to facilitate a transaction somewhere. Mm-hmm. Those are good things. You can't do that if you're small.
You can't do that if you're small. We're in a big global economy. You need big banks. James Kwok is with us, professor at the University of Connecticut Law School. He's followed this very closely. What about the arguments for and against here, James Kwok? And if you would, first, just some numbers on the scale. I mean, I'm looking here, 1970, the top, five banks had 17% of the financial industry's assets. Now the top five have more than half. I mean, the number, the supersized scale of things, help us get a grip on that.
Yeah, what happened in the last about 20 years is that there's been a big merger wave in the United States. Mm-hmm. So what's happened, for example, if you look at J.P. Morgan used to be Manufacturers Hanover, Chase Manhattan, Bank One, J.P. Morgan, a whole bunch of other banks. I was looking at the numbers. As I said earlier, we talked about the Safe Banking Act talks about bank holding companies being no more than $1.3 trillion. In the late 1990s, when Citigroup and Travelers merged to create what was then the largest financial institution in the United States, each one had about $700 billion in assets in today's money. So the mega bank is really a very modern phenomenon.
So Jamie Dimon says, and you just heard him there on tape, saying we need banks this size to service huge corporations and interest in a huge global economy. They're sort of required scale.
Yeah, this is an attractive argument that I think doesn't hold up to analysis. The argument is basically that big corporations are looking for a one-stop shop. So the idea is that some big corporation, they need a bridge loan, he said, $10 billion. They want to get it in one place, so they come to J.P. Morgan. The fact is that if that's what corporations want, today's banks aren't nearly big enough to serve them. So, for example, in another context, I was doing some research. I looked up some bond offerings by Johnson & Johnson. Johnson & Johnson is a big American corporation.
Mm-hmm.
The main way that big American corporations raise money is by selling bonds, by issuing bonds. And I want to make two points about this. One is that companies have been issuing bonds for decades, and the investment banks that underwrote these offerings used to be much smaller than they are today. And the second point I want to make is that Johnson & Johnson used about 13 different banks to underwrite its bond offering around the world. And they do that because they need global scale, and they need lots of people who can underwrite the offering and distribute it to investors. And today's banks aren't even close to that. So large companies are used to working with many banks. They don't actually want one-stop shops.
What's the difference? If you break up the banks, presumably that capital will go elsewhere, so you have more banks holding bigger chunks of that capital. But, I mean, back in the Great Depression, smaller banks went under too. So what's the difference if you break it up?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, if you think about why financial crises happen, why banks go under, there are a couple of different reasons. One is that banks can make bad loans, they can have toxic assets, and they can become insolvent, and they can fail. And the FDIC is quite good at handling this when it comes to small banks. About 300 small banks, I believe, have failed since 2008, and you haven't heard about it in the news at all because it's been a non-event. The other reason you can have a financial crisis is if you have a liquidity panic, and this is what happened in 2008. So remember, the housing bubble started to collapse in 2006, but it wasn't until September 2008 that that people started talking about the world ending. And that was because Lehman Brothers failed. And when Lehman Brothers failed, it was so big that it affected the money markets. What happened is one of the largest money market funds in the country announced that it was not going to be able to pay back investors $1 for every dollar they had invested. That caused
breaking
panic.
The buck.
Yes. And what people were really afraid of was that real corporations would not be able to raise money to meet their payroll. That was the nightmare scenario. And that happened because Lehman Brothers had that scale. And then the next day, as we know, it appeared that AIG was about to fail. And no one had any idea what that would cause because so many large institutions had a lot of exposure to AIG. So when you have these very large institutions, you have this potential for a liquidity panic that can take down even banks that are solvent. If you look at something like Wells Fargo in 2008, probably big bank in the best shape at that time, they needed a bailout too, simply because at that point the market didn't trust any bank.
There was a time, January 2010, President Obama said, "We are going to get out from under the shadow of banks that are too big to fail." He outlined his administration's plans to improve the economy, promising that taxpayers would no longer be on the hook to mega banks.
To identify system-wide risks that could cause a meltdown, to strengthen capital and liquidity requirements to make the system more stable, and to ensure that the failure of any large firm does not take the entire economy down with it. Never again will the American taxpayer be held hostage by a bank that is too big to fail.
Well, okay, but here we are, it's years later now, Jamie Dimon before the Senate Banking Committee today, and we've still got mega banks. But Dimon and others make the case we need them. Tough critics say, no, we don't, and in fact, we can't afford to keep them. James Kwok, please stand by there in Amherst, Massachusetts. Joining us right now from Washington is Peter Wallison, fellow in financial policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, served as general counsel for the Treasury Department and White House counsel to President Ronald Reagan. Peter Wallison, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
You make the case that we need these big banks. What is it? Why?
Well, I actually don't make the case that we need the big banks. The case I make is we don't have any idea what size banks should be if we did break them up. The issue with the big banks is whether they have competitive advantages because they're so large, because people believe that they will be bailed out because they're too big to fail.
Isn't it pretty clear they have those advantages?
Sure, of course, mm-hmm, and that's what's wrong. The problem is that there are these large banks that have competitive advantages over smaller banks. And what we want to do is have a really competitive system where that doesn't occur. So we have things like the Safe Banking Act, which would cut the size of these banks in half.
This is Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown and others proposing to push this through. Yeah.
Right. Now, is half the size of these banks? Does that make them not too big to fail? I doubt it. See, the problem is that there's a lot of very loose talk about breaking up the banks. People are very frustrated about the fact that there are these very large banks. So am I. Senator Shelby, who's the leading Republican on these issues in the Senate, is also concerned about that, as he should be, because it adversely affects our competitive system. But nobody has a really very good idea what size banks would be or have to be so that they wouldn't be considered by the regulators as too big to fail.
Is that a good reason not to act here? I mean, we can't just sit here like idiots if they're too big and do nothing.
Well, wait a minute. If the point is that we want to make them if the point is we want to make this a more competitive system, we want to eliminate, just like James Kwok was saying, if we want to eliminate their competitive advantages, we have to eliminate the fact that they are too big to fail. Okay, so let's decide what is the size that they have to be so that they are not too big to fail. And if being half the size or being a quarter of the size or being even a tenth the size means they are still too big to fail from the standpoint of the regulators, then we haven't really done what we are intending to do, which is to make the system more competitive.
James Kwok, are we just flummoxed by the math here? Is there some problem with figuring out what would be an acceptable size? And then as citizens who may not want to bail out banks and may not want to see this anti-competitive dynamic, isn't there some formula here that ought to work?
Well, I think Peter has a very good point. I mean, one of the things about today's banking industry is that it is complicated, and we don't know, for example, We don't have a firm handle on exactly what the impact would be of, you know, U.S. Bank, which is kind of a second-tier, very large bank. We don't have a firm handle on the impact of what a failure of U.S. Bank would mean for the rest of the financial system. We do know that in 2009, I believe it was, we allowed CIT to fail. And CIT had about $80 billion in assets. So the line is somewhere between $80 billion and $2 trillion. I agree that's a long way. I think, as I said, I think Peter is right. We don't know exactly what the number is. I think we need more analysis. I think the real question you want to analyze is you want to analyze what are the exposures that other financial institutions have to a given bank and what would actually happen if it failed and what is the threshold. That said, you know, I think I'm in the camp that you well, I share the frustration that you expressed, Tom, which is that I think something is better than nothing, and I think that smaller banks would also help some of the other problems we talked about, such as being too big to manage and too big to hedge.
I guess people are not looking for a formula for paralysis here. They're looking to get things fixed. Let's hear from our listeners, Dan in Suwanee, Tennessee. Dan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
Just a quick question. What's happened to our antitrust legislation? I mean, if you're too big to fail, you should be too big to exist. And that's basically been a premise of the way this country was built, and we've been through it several times in our history. I would like the professor to maybe address that issue.
Great question. Does it apply here, James Kwok, antitrust in the banking world?
So antitrust does have some applications to banking. The simple fact, which I will concede, is that banking is less concentrated than some other industries that that the Department of Justice thinks are okay. These days, for the last, say, 30 or 40 years, antitrust analysis has generally taken the perspective of what is best for consumers from the standpoint of pricing. So the Department of Justice will approve mergers of very large companies if it thinks that those mergers will make the resulting company more efficient so it can offer lower prices to consumers.
But we've seen banking fees up and up.
That is true. I mean, it's also true, one thing we haven't talked about is that the large banks have a great deal of market power, especially in certain markets like mortgages and credit cards. To date, the main implications of antitrust for banks have been there's currently a limit, a 10% limit on the deposits that any bank can have of the total market. That limit has some loopholes, which the Safe Banking Act wants to close. And antitrust also applies to bank mergers. You can't have too much concentration in a given market. But I think, you know, unfortunately from my perspective, I think that the current state of the law is that on a nationwide basis, the current level of concentration in banking under existing theories of antitrust is acceptable.
But Congress can just go in and legislate, I guess. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Scott in Des Moines, Iowa. Scott, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think no matter what you do regulation-wise, the banks are going to continually try to work in the gray area or just
plane go around it.
Right.
And plus, you know, with having to go through Congress, you know, to try to negotiate decent regulation, why can't we just tell the FDIC that, you know, hey, you know, if you folks want a proprietary trade and engage in risky behavior, that's fine. But we're not going to cover your deposits. And then that way, the market, you know, the depositors being the market will, you know,
yeah,
will force the banks to engage in less risky behavior, and then the market does it, and you don't waste a bunch of time on regulation.
It's a sharp thought. Peter Wallison, how about it? Just drop the insurance and see what happens.
Absolutely. I think it's a very good idea. And there have been proposals for a long time to create something called a wholesale bank, and that would be a bank that would not have deposit insurance, would deal only in the capital markets, and meanwhile it might have a subsidiary or might not have a subsidiary. That is the kind of bank that is on street corners throughout the United States and where people put their money and have that money insured by the government. That would be fine, and I think a lot of banks would be very favorable to that. It almost came about in 1999.
But would it give us smaller banks, Mr. Wallison?
Well, sure, it would give us smaller banks that are insured banks, if we're getting to the caller's question.
Yeah.
We would have much smaller banks that are insured, but we would still have very, very large banks by anyone's measurement that would be engaged in wholesale activities throughout the world, just like J.P. Morgan Chase does today. If we took J.P. Morgan Chase and we divided it up between the bank that takes deposits and then all the other activities that the bank does, you'd probably find that the bank that takes deposits is about a quarter of the size of the entire bank. And so then you'd have three-quarters of the bank would be off the government's roll, so to speak. It would be competing with a whole lot of other financial institutions all around the world.
But still out there at mega size. James Kroc, would that solve the risk factor here, if I may, James, or not?
So I want to let you get back to Peter because I think
I will. Yeah.
Yeah, but what I'll say is that I don't think it would, because we're talking about two different kinds of government guarantees. The FDIC insurance is an explicit government guarantee, and then the expectation of a rescue in a crisis is an implicit guarantee, and it's very hard to take that away, because I think maybe Peter was going in this direction. If J.P. Morgan still has $1.5 trillion in its wholesale bank that is still crucial to the economy, you would still expect it to be bailed out.
Peter, still the implicit guarantee.
I was going directly there, and James picked that right up. Sure, it wouldn't change anything substantially on the question that we're dealing with, and that is, would the government step in to rescue a very large financial institution? And the answer is, if it's $1.5 trillion, or it's $1 trillion, or maybe it's $500 billion, who knows, the government would probably still step in, because that's the way regulators do things. They are afraid to allow any kind of substantial disruption to occur in the markets, and so they tend to step in and rescue these institutions. We don't solve the problem, in other words, by simply breaking these things up into a wholesale bank and an insured bank. Insurance isn't the issue here.
But you
the
can
issue
understand
is the size
people's
of the institutions.
But people don't want to hear, you know, this wouldn't change anything, that wouldn't change anything. I mean, we're being told we have a systemic problem. And
let's try to be part of it. I think we have to be responsible about this too. We also have an economy and we have a financial system.
It almost came down.
And the fact that people are frustrated is one thing, but we want to be sure we don't take actions that actually make things worse.
But it almost came down on its own volition and within the very recent memory of a lot of people listening.
We'll come back and look at that.
Well, we'll look back at 2008. Peter Wallison, standby in Washington. James Kroc in Amherst, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon on the hot seat today in Congress. We're talking about the call and effort to just break up America's biggest banks, make them smaller, no more too big to fail. With James Kroc, co-author of White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You, and Peter Wallison, fellow in financial policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Jamie Dimon, of course, before the Senate Banking Committee this morning. Here he is talking about the risks that were taken, the loss, of course, everybody knows, billions. He said that his bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, tried to reduce risk-weighted assets and associated risks in its investment portfolio. And you'll hear here his apology.
To achieve this in the synthetic credit portfolio, the CIO could have simply reduced its existing positions. Instead, starting in mid-January, it embarked on a complex strategy that entailed adding positions that it believed that it did believe would offset the existing ones. This strategy, however, ended up creating a portfolio that was larger and ultimately resulted in even more complex and hard to manage risks. This portfolio morphed into something that, rather than protect the firm, created new and potentially larger risks. As a result, we have let a lot of people down, and we are very sorry for it.
We are very sorry for it. Same CEO called it a tempest in a teapot just weeks ago. Now billions lost, and he's sitting there this morning before the Senate Banking Committee. James Kwok, let's go back to just a sort of simple marker here, but a very big one. 08, Peter Wallison says, well, you know, it's not necessarily about the size of the banks there. Did we see a case in point of too big to fail, the too big bank problem in 08, James?
Well, I think the debate between people like Peter and people like me on this point is the question of whether it was necessary to first to rescue AIG and then to bail out the nine largest banks in the country. I would say that a lot of people, including me, think that this was necessary. I think that I have a lot of issues with the way it was done. I think in many ways it was too generous to the banks. But I believe if you think back to the end of September and early October, I would point out two things. One was that there was a great panic. You could see it in the stock market. You could see it in firm behavior at the time. And my favorite anecdote, in some ways I think the most compelling evidence of this, is Mohammed Aryan, who's the co-CEO of the world's largest bond trading firm, and, you know, nobody's fool, apparently called his wife and told her to go to the ATM and take out as much cash as she could, because he didn't know if banks would be opening in the morning. And then the other thing I would point out is at this point in October 2008, we were actually – the United States was behind in responding to this crisis. Various European countries had introduced measures to recapitalize their banks or to provide some guarantees to their banks in order to shore up the system. And at that point, I think, essentially the world was looking to the United States to do something. Now, we'll never know what would have happened if the government had simply sat on its hands. So it's in a sense, it's an argument that we can have for the next century.
Well, and meanwhile, we've got this exposure. Peter Wallace, and you may think that the government should not have bailed them out, but politics being what they are and fear, they did. I mean, what's to stop that from almost certainly happening again if you got into that kind of teetering posture?
Yeah, I don't say the government should not have done what it did. One of the questions is why the government was in a position that there was a gigantic panic going on. The point about the banks, however, is somewhat different from what people are saying about, say, AIG or even Lehman Brothers. The banks were all given some money, which is called the bailout. This is the TARP money that they received. All of them, with the exception of Citibank, then repaid that money within 8 months. The reason they were given the money in the first place was to allay the panic, to make people feel more comfortable. The banks did not, I believe, need the money. They hadn't suffered losses that required them to keep that money that was called bailout money. That's a very important point. We go around saying, well, they were all bailed out and so forth, as though they needed these funds in order to continue operating. They actually didn't. We were just trying – what the government was trying to do was to make the market, investors and participants in the market, feel more comfortable, feel as though something good was being done, that the panic was being addressed. So –
But that's what markets are, right? Feelings are part of markets.
Sure.
I mean, you're never going to get away from that.
Absolutely. But we haven't had a panic like what we had in 2008. Probably in 80 years, if you consider the Depression that. And more likely since 1907, with the panic of 1907. So this was a very, very unusual set of circumstances. And again, we are trying to establish policy because of frustrations about what happened in 2008. By saying, well, let's just do something. Let's get something done that will solve the problem that came to the fore in 2008. When what we really ought to do is figure out why we had the panic in 2008. and then step back from that and say, what policies should we change in order to avoid having another panic like this? And I think those issues have never been fully addressed.
Well, so you say, and we've got it, but you've got serious people saying that size is a fundamental part of it. You've got Richard Fisher, head of the Federal Reserve in Dallas. You've got Bullard, head of the Federal Reserve in St. Louis, James Bullard there. You've got, I mean, I'm reading here Phil Angelides, who headed up the Congressional Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, says these banks are too big to fail, too big to manage, too big to regulate. They're too complex to understand. They're too risky to exist. And the bottom line is, he says, they offer very little benefit. Bill in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I think that what we need to do is to break up these banks and, in effect, create more diversity in the overall portfolio that people have. Like what we did with AT&T quite a few years ago was break that up into smaller banks. We didn't destroy any
of the communications companies.
Mm-hmm. We didn't destroy any of the value of the company. We just split it up more so that if one of them would fail, it wouldn't send shockwaves throughout the whole economy.
James Kwok, is that a model? Can we look back to that kind of AT&T breakup? What would your ideal be, James, if you want them to be smaller?
The other model is Standard Oil, which was broken up into many pieces, which immediately became worth more than Standard Oil was before the breakup. You know, I think that this is essentially what people like me are arguing for. Now, I'll give the counter-argument. I mean, the counter-argument is that there's a certain minimum scale that banks need to have to do certain kinds of operations, such as global derivatives trading and so on. And I think that that's an assumption that I don't agree with, and I think that we need to argue about. As I said, we're talking about making banks about as big as they were in the late 1990s. If you think about the American capital markets in the 1990s, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley did a perfectly good job of raising capital for firms either through equity or through debt. They did a perfectly good job of helping companies hedge their real exposures. What's happened in the past decade, and what's made these banks in many ways much bigger, has been the explosion of the derivatives markets. That is a major reason why these banks feel like they need to be so much bigger today than they needed to be 15 years ago. And then I think that leads to the next question, which is, you know, not the topic of today's conversation, but what have we gotten for that explosion in derivatives trading?
And the top five banks is J.P. Morgan, Citi, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, with 95% of derivatives held by U.S. bank holding companies. Hillary at Owensboro, Kentucky. Hillary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
I just wanted to voice several years back, I worked for a bank in Kentucky. I was in the public relations department and worked as an event planner. And my comment and question is, the officers of the bank, in particular, had budgets that they had to use every year. And at the end of the tax year, if they hadn't used their budgets, then they would plan incredible getaways or, spa-type places to go, the
sure.
Kentucky Derbies, the money spent that I think should be spent on customers or to feed the poor or whatever, but say that the trust officer or the CEO would, they had an entire facility for the officers only, and it was a multi-million dollar facility so that they could keep their cholesterol and their weight down. No one could use it, even though it was multi-million dollars to build it. If their cholesterol went up 5 points, they had to take time off.
Boy, we're all for good health, but you're talking about some big expenditures and maybe wonder how those get concentrated. I've got one more on that front, Hillary, if you'll permit me. Let me get one. Peter in Norwood. Thank you, Hillary. Peter, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is CEO compensation. The compensation that CEOs have been getting has the upside for them, but there's no downside. They've got no skin in the game. So what that has done with the whole industry has pushed everyone to these crazy bets now. They're not even investing in the normal economy. They're just betting on who knows what.
If you're the London Whale, we now know what, and it didn't work out too well. $100 million or something like that there. Jamie Dimon, of course, paid very large James Kwok, I'm looking at Mike Mayo. He's an analyst with CLSA. He says the biggest motivation for not breaking up the banks is that top managers would earn less. You said earlier, James, that they still earn a lot, but, you know, tastes ride very high once you get on this kind of train.
Yeah, so there was a famous chart in The Economist at least 10 years ago which showed plotted CEO compensation at banks against the size of their assets, and it was essentially a straight line. The larger the bank, the more money people make. You know, I think that executive compensation is an important issue. I would say that it's actually less the amount of the compensation that matters, although the amount is what gets a lot of people frustrated.
And keeps them lobbying very hard in Washington for the status quo.
But it's the structure of the compensation. I think what we've seen recently is that people get on the trading level, people get bonuses in cash that cannot be taken back. So what happens is you put on some trade in July. On December 31st, it looks like you made the bank a lot of money. You get a big bonus. In January, the trade plummets. You lost a lot of money. No one can take your bonus back. It leads to a lot of short-term behavior. The same thing to a lesser degree is true of CEOs. They're paid largely in stock these days. But if you look at someone like Dick Fult, who is CEO of Lehman Brothers, it's true that he had a lot of stock in Lehman the day that it collapsed. It's also true that he had sold hundreds of millions of dollars of stock in the years before. So I think that, you know, the problem is one of trying to get it has two parts. One is trying to get CEOs' incentives aligned with those of the shareholders, which is, a basic corporate governance problem. But there's another problem with it. To explain this, I'll skip the technical details, but in some ways, the shareholders have the same incentives to take on too much risk. Because if you think about banks that are too big to fail, they're passing on their losses to creditors and to the government. So some people have argued that aligning CEOs' incentives with those of the shareholders, even that is not enough, and we have to think more creatively about how to do it.
Peter Wallison, where do you think we go here? We come back in 5 years. Is it going to be the same kind of scale we're looking at, or do you feel enough fire in the belly in Washington for something to be done in terms of bringing down the size? You say we don't know what the right size is, but to bring it down. Do you see it happening?
No, I don't, because, what we do in Washington has to be done responsibly. And, in fact, you don't find the Treasury Department, even in the Obama administration, agreeing with the idea that these banks have to be cut in it to any smaller size. I think they understand the problem, and that is that we have gotten ourselves into a situation where they're very large banks. We might be able to do things to cause them to break up themselves to a smaller size by increasing their capital requirements or their insurance premiums, but just breaking them up just by saying you shall be half the size tomorrow isn't a good policy.
Watch this space. You've got some big folks pushing for exactly that. Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute, thank you very much for being with us. And James Kwok at the University of Connecticut Law School, thanks to you both. In a moment, a commencement speech from animal behavior specialist Temple Grandin on human behavior and the importance of doing and making things that matter. This is On Point. Last month, renowned animal scientist and best-selling author Temple Grandin addressed graduates at her alma mater, Franklin Pierce University in Ringe, New Hampshire. As a person with high-functioning autism, Temple Grandin has used her ability as a visual thinker to revolutionize humane livestock handling. She spoke to new graduates about visualizing the world and money and doing things that matter.
I didn't know that other people were not visual thinkers. Now I know that there's other people that are mathematical thinkers, and there's others that are word thinkers, and their skills can complement each other. They need to work together. Let's take something like the Japanese nuclear power plant. As a visual thinker, there's no way I would have put the emergency generators in the basement when you live next to the sea, because I can see the water going in there. And I've done a lot of work with industrial equipment, and diesels don't work underwater. It's just that simple. And when I was young, I used to think that was due to stupidity. You know what? I think it's they don't see it. The mathematicians that design the reactor don't see that water in the basement might be really, really bad thing. Now, all people with autism are bottom-up thinkers. I form a concept by putting specific examples into file folders. And one of my big concerns today in policy making is what I call abstractification. We've got people going into Washington, D.C., making policy that have no firsthand experience on the ground with the things that they're making policy about. I think this is really bad. Getting too far away from the world of practical things. Well, you know, like they people talk about big amounts of money, you know, like, you know, $5 billion here, $20 billion here. What does that mean? I have to convert it to a picture. $5 billion is what it cost to build our Denver airport about 15 years ago. So I take the thing when they say, well, this cost, you know, two-thirds of a, you know, Denver airport, or this cost five Denver airports. That makes that money real. Maybe we need to be thinking about it that way. I'm really concerned that in this country right now, we spend more money litigating and fighting over patents than we do inventing things. That is beyond atrocious. And when I was a student here, they put the time capsule in the library, and I sneaked into the maintenance shop and added something to the time capsule. And what I added to it was, what is knowledge and why do we seek it? That's an age-old question. Well, what we need to be doing is we need to be using our knowledge to get out and do real stuff. I'm a child of the 50s. Well, the Republicans built the interstate highway system. The Democrats went to the moon. We did stuff. We got to get back to doing real stuff. One thing you definitely should not be doing is being the inventor of the next credit default swap. We need to be doing real stuff that makes real change. And avoid abstractification, and it's been a real honor to be here.
Temple Grandin speaking to 2012 graduates at Franklin Pierce University in Ringe, New Hampshire last month. For a video and transcript, go to our website, onpointradio.org. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website as well, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.